Hi there, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Desi VC Podcast. I'm your host, Akash Bhatt, and I bring you leading investors and operators investing and building companies all around the world. Firstly, I'd like to apologize to each and every listener of the podcast because I've been quiet for a little over 3.5-4 months now, and that's only because I've been extremely caught up in my own personal entrepreneurial journey. Having said that, I have a great list of operators as well as VCs lined up over the course of the next couple of months, so stay tuned as we're bringing the show back on track. And kicking off the reboot is Shwetank Verma, who is the managing partner at Leo Capital, a venture capital fund investing in companies in India and Southeast Asia. Their recent investments include Upmesh, Cyber Sierra, Devtron Labs, among many others. He's previously led open innovation for MetLife Asia and was part of the senior management team of Lumen Lab, MetLife's innovation consultancy. At Lumen Lab, he advised MetLife country CEO and senior leaders on growth, startup collaboration, culture change, and new product development. Prior to that, he was a serial entrepreneur in healthcare and education in India. He serves as an innovation advisor to the Institute of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Singapore Management University, and is also a fellow of the Institute of Chartered Accountants, England and Wales, and holds a Bachelor's of Science in Economics and Econometrics from the University of Nottingham in the UK. This is a great episode because we will be delving a little bit more deeper into what a multi-operator fund really brings to the table and the kind of value that they add to entrepreneurs. The partners at Leo have all built successful companies over the course of their careers and are now bringing that experience and expertise to helping other founders scale their companies. So without further ado, let's head in and listen to this fantastic episode featuring Shwetank. Shwetank, welcome to the Desi VC Podcast. Really excited to have you here. I'm looking forward to the next 45-50 minutes and delve deeper into your experience investing in companies in India.
Thanks, Akash. Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
I typically kickstart the podcast by asking people about, you know, where we are as an industry right now. I'm going to pose a very similar question to you as well. We've obviously been through a very difficult period in what I would put 2023 as. How have you seen the last 12 months? And where are we today as we stand from an investor point of view?
Yeah, it's a great question, Akash. As you said, the last year was one that I'm sure most of us would like to forget. But overall, you know, these kind of hard years, I think, help clarify the industry. They help the tourists sort of leave. They realize that it's not the promised land. So I think, you know, venture in India is still early in its evolution. You know, it's, let's say it's what, 20 years sort of at best. It's been going on for significantly longer in the valley. So this was a good correction. I think it has cleared out a lot of sort of people who are just in venture for quick returns, which is not the asset class for that. And, you know, the people who are staying back are people who truly enjoy the craft of venture, of building these businesses that take, you know, 5 to 15 years, closer to 15 rather than 5.
Let's actually get into that, because there are a couple of things there that were really interesting. And one you mentioned is craft of being a good investor, or just craft of investing, right? Because there's a lot that goes into just being a good investor. Now, in your opinion, one, what makes a good investor? And two, how do you then define yourself particularly in the context of that definition?
Yeah, it's a great question, Akash, and I'm not sure I'm a good investor just yet, but the way I thought of Leo when we started it was, what would we want as, you know, coming from the operator side, what would I want the ideal investor to be, right? And sort of the ideal investor, in my mind, is that wonderful coach, right? You know, the coach is there next to you while you're playing. He's telling you, or she's telling you, how to improve your swing, you know, where where you're getting it wrong on the technical side, so tactics, while also helping you over time with your mental side, the strategy, right? So if I take the coaching analogy, that's sort of the ideal investor who's able to think through how to add value in the heat of the battle. There's a few key points which can make a difference, but over time strengthen you for the battle so that you're really actually able to make the decision yourself and win. Because ultimately the player has to win.
Right.
The coach can only do that much. And I think it's understanding that you're a coach and not the player, especially as an operator at NVC, that sort of flip is a challenging one. And I think that's what we try to be at Leo. You know, how do we be the best coaches? Adding value in the here and now, but actually making sure that you're getting better on this craft, on this sort of journey of building your business, so that you're building the best business you can in the 5 to 10 year horizon that you're doing this, at least.
Now, extending your analogy there itself, you talk about coaching. In my opinion, and what I would think some sports fans would also resonate with, is some of the best coaches are not the people who come with the best strategies or ideas. It's the best people who are great at man management and people who can adapt themselves to the people or the players on their team. Quite similarly, I think with a growing portfolio, an investor who, in this example, is a coach, probably also learns a lot more about the diversified, I would say, risk or bets in their portfolio. Now, having said that, as the portfolio companies at Leo have grown and as the fund sizes have grown over the years as well, what are some of the biggest takeaways that you've had working with founders today in comparison with the other ones that you've had in the past? Like, what's evolved over these years investing in India?
Yeah, I think so. It's been an interesting 5 year journey for us at Leo, and now almost 10 years, 10 plus years for me in the ecosystem, both as a founder, angel, and VC investor. So I'd say the most visible evolution is in the ambition of founding teams. So, you know, back in 2018, you know, founding team would be, because would not really think about path to $1 billion in revenue or you know, massive market cap. It would be more about, hey, I think we can get to 5, 10 million. And at the seed stage, that is all that people were thinking about. They were not thinking about how you would go further. And that was perfectly fair, because you'd go further as you went along. But today's founding teams start with the greater ambition because they've seen greater success. So founding teams are stepping off, you know, successes like Paytm, Meesho, Flipkart, where they've seen scale, they've seen real outcomes, and they've seen real impact. And that translates into much more ambition on day zero. That's been a great thing to see, and a great thing to observe as the ecosystem, you know, evolves and matures. I think the other elements that has happened over the years is just much more confidence in the brand of India, so especially for India, for the world. You know, previously you'd have sort of, you'd still be building in India, but you'd perhaps not make it a big part of your story that you're building in India, that your teams are in India, your supporters, your customer success is in India. I think people will become much more comfortable around, that is who we are, that's what we're building, and it's going to be the best product and the most innovative product that you'll find. So the India story has gone from being a cost arbitrage to being high-class innovation and world-class talent. And that has accelerated over the last 5 years, which I'm very excited about.
It's a very interesting point that you bring up there, because the India story has evolved so rapidly in the last 10 years that there's been three versions of it that's going to come up. We've obviously had that initial story of, technology that transformed what, in my words and definition, what my parents used to do, which is groceries, dropping me to school, so on and so forth. Things that, automated and brought technology to that stack. And there was
digitization, which was between the 2014 to 2018, 2019, where you ended up seeing a lot of the stuff that I was doing getting, backed by heavy technology. And now we're in that third wave where almost everything else is like on steroids. Like things that existed is on steroids, but newer technology is obviously popping up from time to time in new sectors and new and sectors where India was perhaps not seen as a leader, showing up and positioning itself. Space tech is a good example where we've been making tremendous strides. Pharma is another one that we've been making good progress. Now, as you're looking at this evolving landscape within India, where does Leo and you personally stand on the next 5 to 10 years of evolution coming about? We've obviously seen, this fantastic wave that's put India on the map, and everybody wants to look at India from a macro perspective as well of investment. And China is kind of becoming a little bit more, I want to, redundant is a very harsh word, but less attractive to global investors.
Challenging,
Yeah,
challenging, yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, with geopolitical tensions and everything. But where India, on the other hand, is kind of like becoming much more of an attractive option than ever before. And with every passing day, the potential is just there to be seen. So how do you see the next 5 years? Let's not even put 10, because I think in 10 years a lot could change. But in the next 5 years, where's Leo placing its bets? Where are you seeing the biggest innovations coming about?
And let me take up your first point on the three waves. So I actually think of the three waves in sort of slightly even longer back, right? And you can simplify them in first, it was tell us what to do. That was the outsourcing wave that made us a lot of money
Right.
as India.
Right.
Second was let me copy what you do. This was the fast follower model, right? So again, made a lot of money. And now we are at we'll tell you we are building something new. And that's the wave that is currently cresting in India. So, there's de novo product development. And as you mentioned, a lot of things in India actually are now absolutely cutting edge. Because I spend my time all over the world, you see it, right? I mean, you see it with something as simple as payments to the home delivery of everything, the convenience and the cutting edgeness of India's consumer tech. It's quite incredible. And if you haven't been to the country in the last 5 years, your mental map is completely outmoded. So, I think that I see a lot, especially in my international travels. Folks who have last visited India in, say, 2010, are unable to comprehend what the country has become today, just because it is changing so rapidly and is on such a fascinating trajectory. So that sort of helps you understand our worldview, and it's sort of the wave of third wave of brand new cutting edge innovation first technologies from India for the world is where we are investing today as well, Akash. So that's where we see the next 5 years going. And category creating software being created in India is the bet that we want to take, but category creation for the world, so not just the Indian consumer. The Indian consumer, I think, is a great great macro story, lots of investing opportunities, but we are not brand investors. So it's hard for us to invest in D2C brands. It's hard for us to back the consumption story that much. But we think that the global technology story is one that is more exciting for us from an investment perspective. And India building for the world, and India building not for the world, not only from as Indian entrepreneurs, but the Indian ecosystem powering the world, empowering the startup world. So the one way to think about it is that one out of every four working people will be Indian in the next 10 years, just by the nature of the size of our employee base and demographics, etc. So how does Leo become the first global fund coming out of India? That's the question we've asked ourselves, and that's what we're trying to solve. You think about it, Sequoia, Accel, etc., global funds out of US, GGV, and a couple others went through from China. And of course, because of the current global situation, they've all severed their ties to China, but they're historically China and taking sort of Chinese insights, etc., outside to the world. And I think the time is now right for Indian insights and Indian talent to be sort of going outside and being part of the overall global story, and that's what we try to do at Leo. And maybe an example here is helpful. So something like QR code payments. You know, how do you take that to a developed market? So like we've invested in a company called Atua Payments in the UK, which is taking QR code payments to the UK built on open banking and now scaling very nicely there. How do you take, so say something like social commerce on Meesho outside? So we've got a company like Elena's in Colombia. So that is, you know, trying to build the Meesho of LATAM. So that's, so what we think about is how do we invest in talent insight and insights from India across a global canvas? And that's what we're doing with the next slide is.
You talked about category creation play from India for the globe. Now, that's a very hard thing to do, given, you know, the nascency of a lot of entrepreneurs in this space who probably haven't done category creation plays outside of India. Within India, for sure, there's a lot of localization and personalization that gives you opportunities to do that within the country. But have you seen good examples, you know, of founders trying to do this at scale at a global level from a category creation standpoint?
So yeah, I mean, I think you're right that you know absolute de novo category creation is tough. So maybe we should reframe that as category leadership. But that in that you end up with a lot more stories that are getting to success stories level. Category creation, I think a lot of you know we are seeing more and more companies attempting it, but it's all early, and it'll have to be seen how that plays out. But you know, in sort of newer technologies, things like AI, etc., allow you to create interesting workflows, opportunities. Now you can keep arguing whether that's category creation or just repurposing an existing spend, but it is effectively new way of doing things, so we can count it as category creation.
Understood. Now, well, bringing you back to a point that you made earlier, and it's kind of been playing on my mind ever since you said that. You talked about, you know, being an operator in the past and having had that experience working with investors from the other side of the table, and the kind of investor you are today, or the kind of investors you all are today at Leo, because from the outside, it's very evident that it's an operator-led, you know, fund. You know, all of you have been operators, all of you have had successful stints as operators, and of course being on the other side of the table kind of gives you that opportunity of understanding what is it that founders need, and the fact that you've all been through multiple stages kind of gives you an insight as to what is needed at different stages as well, from an investor lens, from a founder lens, from an investor, if I can put it that way. Now, having this is the that million-dollar question that people keep debating constantly. Like, as an investor, do you need to have that experience of having gone and built something and really gotten your hands dirty, or can you actually just purely be an investor? And the answer to the latter is perhaps yes. With time, you build that metal, and you have that hard skin that gets developed over time. But then, from your point of view, right now as we sit, what is the best mold for an investor in India, investing and working very closely with Indian entrepreneurs? What is needed? Is it just, you know, quote unquote, like high level stuff, or is it more, hey, I've been there, I've been in the weeds, I can tell you, like, more like stuff that will actually be helpful? Like, what in your opinion kind of like works best?
Yeah, this is an ongoing debate, right, Akash? And I think when I started the journey, I was indexing heavily on the operator backstory and experience, and I thought that would certainly make me a better investor. But I'm spending more time as a VC. I'm not sure that there's as many. There are a lot of positives from the operator journey, but there are also a few key negatives that you have to learn over time as a VC to sort of
Like,
move away from, because you're no longer an operator.
I'm curious to
I
hear
think
the negatives actually.
the negative is just this, that you know that you forget that you're not an operator, so you try and effectively become a co-CEO to the entrepreneur,
Yeah.
which is a terrible thing to do. And you know I'm sure I was guilty of it originally. I'm trying my best not to be guilty of it anymore. You know, you go too much into the weeds. I think as an ex-operator, you start sort of saying, hey, let's, tell me exactly how you're doing something. And again, as a board member, that's perhaps not the best use of your time and everyone else's time. So those are some of the downsides. But coming to your, to your question about what's the right mold for a investor, especially in India, and especially then for early stage VC, because I think that, molds are different. If you say you're going to do growth stage investing, then I don't think operating experience matters that much. If you're going to do growth stage investing, you can, it's a rigorous investment apprenticeship can actually do the job as much as operator. But as a early stage tech VC, I do think that having a little bit of on the ground experience in India is still helpful because operations in India remain very challenging. And, being able to sort of have that ground up experience of how the strategic plan will actually need to be translated into a product and outcome, and understanding the journey that the entrepreneur will need to take at least at some level, slightly more internally rather than just at a conceptual level, I think does help at the early stage. And again, we've built Leo on the basis that being an operator is essential to our brand of founder empathy, founder sort of founder trust. And so far we've been very happy with that. But we remain open to the idea that you can be a great investor without operating experience. We just think it'll take some more time in the Indian context before that is true.
No, one of the reasons I asked that is because even the early stage in India has become extremely competitive with the rise of micro VCs, and you have operator-led funds. So the right to win right now is probably at its peak. And I say that knowing that is going to probably continue to be at peaks in the coming years. So today, what makes an investor really attractive to a founder, especially one who is able to like pull in capital better than some others because of technology moats and obviously market moats and perhaps even a first mover advantage in some cases? How do investors, and how did you guys think about it in the early days when you were setting out? Of course, having that operator experience helps. But when you're competing against three or four other funds where there's operating experience available to a founder, how did Leo position itself saying, hey, we can perhaps give you something else that the other operating funds cannot? How did you guys think about it, debate this, and come up with like an internal thesis? It's very interesting to figure this out.
Yeah, you're taking me back sort of 5 years ago. So again, remember we started in 2018, and that's almost 6 years ago now. And even then, the landscape was very different. So 6 years ago, there were hardly any micro VCs. There's hardly any angel, very little angel syndication as well, and there was still very predatory term sheet practices, etc. So we started with a simple promise that we will. We will give you partner time from day one. So we took a conscious decision to build a top-heavy firm from day one. So even if you look at Leo today, you'll see that there's a lot of sort of senior people relative to the number of junior people. So that was one key thing that to say that, hey, let us make sure we are adding value to the entrepreneur from day one so that the entrepreneur says, okay, these are the people that we want to spend the next 10 years of our lives building a business with. Second was really, help the founders understand that the investor you're bringing on board is somebody who's going to be there at least for the next, 6, if not 10 years of your life. So from the founder's perspective, helping them index on, do you enjoy working with this person? Because a lot of founders basically were indexing on, can I get capital and can I get good terms? But helping them understand that this is a really important question that you need to ask in your journey as you raise capital. And that's something that I think founders still don't ask enough in India. If you invest outside, you'll see that founders do a lot of ref checks on the investors. They might even do an interview call with you to see whether they want to take your capital. That ethos has still not yet come in India. And I think that's something that should come. More power in this relationship should transfer to founders. Rather than the way it is today. But yeah, going back to your question, so we said, okay, we'll make sure it's founder first, it's partner first, so you get partner time on day one, and then it is fast nodes, so we don't waste your time, so that it builds, again, builds better goodwill, and surprising that a fast node is goodwill, but a fast node is a lot better than a maybe or
Yeah.
take or ghosting. So no ghosting, fast nodes. And then yes, obviously, when you're saying yes as quickly as you can, get to a yes, clean term sheets, clean terms, and above board at all times, from being fair at all times, from everyone's perspective. Those are the original things in 2018 that helped us win. Over the course, obviously, it's the ability to showcase our portfolio, ask founders whenever we're really competing for a deal, ask founders to talk to some of our other founders. But still, I anchor on this that you will work with one of the Leo partners. You will enjoy working with that person, and you need to think about the relationship you have with your investor over a 5 to 7 year horizon, not over a 3 year horizon.
Yeah.
And touch wood, we've been pretty good at winning our deals, Akash. So fingers crossed, we continue there.
Well, it's always nice to hear that in initial formation of the thesis, because every fund positions themselves differently to founders, and it kind of like makes you also go through a very internal journey of knowing your strengths, weaknesses, and where can you really add value and where you cannot. Like, for example, a fund cannot come out like if I'm starting a fund and I don't have like a strong marketing play, I cannot position myself as a marketing fund. Like, I'm not going to amplify you to an audience or bring you that experience and expertise from a partner perspective, and we probably haven't played any a CMO role. But on the other hand, if you're go-to-market experts and you've kind of like done a lot of cross-border stuff between multiple geographies, selling to the US, you can position yourself as a fund that, hey, we can tell you how to, we can at least coach you, quote unquote, when you need it, about selling in the United States or selling to Southeast Asia, Europe, so on and so forth. So it really takes you through that internal journey as well as partners, how you want to position your own particular strengths.
Yeah, I think you build up an interesting point. I think we're seeing more and more funds come up with specialism, right?
Yeah.
Either a functional specialism or a sectoral specialism, that we're a fintech fund, we're a edtech fund.
Yeah.
We're not. We're generalists.
Yeah.
We enjoy and we know how to help you go through the path of building a company. And building a company means you need to work with multiple specialists and multiple, stakeholders. So we position ourselves as that if you're building a company, you're not building a marketing organization as a company.
Right.
If you're not just, even if you're building an ed tech, it's not just going to be about education or tech. So building a company is a generalist endeavor. And we are the generalist fund that helps you make that happen across various things. We are your sparring partner. It goes back to that original philosophy, Akash, of being the coach. So being the coach, what does that mean? That means at the day one, we help you set the direction of travel and the speed of travel. And then we're helping you decide whether you're going right and you're going the right speed. Because there are no prizes for going wrong direction. There are even no prizes for going the wrong speed. That's
Right.
the harder part. You might be going absolutely right direction, everything's right, but if your speed is too low, as a startup, that's another, you've lost the prize. So we have this debate quite a few times with LPs as well, that how do you compete with a sector specialist or somebody who's adding a lot of value on a certain function. And the answer is that we don't see ourselves as competing with them. Obviously, and we help whenever we are really excited with the founder. We have the founder understand why taking money from us is not competing with them, and why they want to make sure that they give an allocation to the Leo on the cap table before sort of seeing how to bring on a sector specialist or a functional specialist.
That makes sense. Especially as the fund evolves and your corpus size also increases, hopefully, unless you're playing a very benchmark kind of like a game, it becomes increasingly important for you to become great partners at the early stages, especially if you're exercising an opportunity fund and doubling down with your investments as they grow. And showcasing that relationship earlier on obviously then enables you to exercise your pro rata, continue to build good relationships, and perhaps even invest in later stages, which may be sometimes outside of the fund's thesis, or you bring in the LPs who want to continue investing on into companies that continue to like grow well and do well. And that can only happen if your positioning at the early stage is extremely good and strong and you continue to maintain those relationships.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, these things only happen if the founder really wants them to happen for you,
Yeah.
and you build that on day zero. So, you want the founder to look back and say, okay, these folks were really quite instrumental in our start, and hold us, ideally in that regard, as you become less instrumental as you grow, but
Right.
continue to look after things that they can do for us, or add to a seat to some request like pro rata in a later stage round, et cetera. And again, we are very grateful to our founders,
Yeah.
especially those who have scaled, to continue to be very supportive of Leo wherever they can be.
No, I mean, this kind of like brings me back to a question again that I was wanting to ask for a long time, but I think this is a good segue into that. Like, when did you decide to become an investor? And why did you decide to become an investor? Because I think it's a very personal journey for a lot of VCs and different, obviously, reasons why people become an investor. So let me repose those questions to you in three different bullet points. Why did you want to become a VC? When did you decide to become a VC? And did you know that investing or becoming a VC was one of those things that was part of your career roadmap?
Right. You're really taking me down memory lane, Akash. So I started my first company at the age of 19 in the UK. So that was my first entrepreneurial experience. We had fun. We built a small business. I got a little acquisition, et cetera. So I really enjoyed the, I knew that I'd enjoyed that journey, and that sort of, what I'm looking for. That made me, at that point, it was sort of saying that I'll want to do this again and at a larger scale. So that planted the seed of serious entrepreneurship back at the age of 19. And of course, I'd been doing some minor stuff, entrepreneurial stuff before that, but that was a proper company, hiring people and all of that. Then I worked as a sort of in a family office on the investing side for a long time. So that again exposed me to the world of venture and especially venture outside of India. You could see that this is a really interesting asset class. And it's a great way for people with investing backgrounds to continue to be working with exciting early stage technology companies. So I think at that point I knew that investing is going to be a very interesting part of my life and something that I should come back to. Then I did my second startup in India, which was the tougher one. Learned the hard way just how hard it is. We raised money in India. We built a team and we didn't succeed, to be honest. We had a sale, but it was more of an acqui-hire than a sale. And I think that made me really think about what am I good as a leader, as an operator. And I remember sort of writing this down and thinking hard about it and coming to the conclusion that I'm a better coach than player. I prefer the portfolio rather than maniacal focus. I prefer, being able to catalyze a really good operator to the next level rather than being that person, sort of driving the company forward. And so at that point, it became clear that the only career path that is going to give me fulfillment is venture. Because I didn't want to do this on the public market side. It just makes you an investor pattern recognition rather than the human side, which is venture. So that was key that I can't do this in long only equity, for instance. Certainly can't do it in hedge funds, et cetera. The quant is just way too much for me. So it left only this option. And then when I looked around at that time, so this was what, 2016 or something, I looked around and, at that point, the entrepreneurial instinct sort of kicked in and said, actually, there's space in India for a brand new firm rather than joining an existing firm. And that's how sort of, and Rajul was thinking the same thing, and he'd been an investor in my company in India. So that's how we met. He's an angel on my cap table. So we started going for our walks in Lodi Garden because we were living nearby there. And before we knew it, the plan for Leo had been hatched, and here we are.
And it's a very fascinating story that your investor is now your partner, and you kind of now have built this fund from the ground up. And that in and of itself is, again, another entrepreneurial journey. The way I look at it is like a startup. I mean, it's just that you pretend to be an investor, but while building a company from the ground up, and your portfolio companies in some sense are like your customers, you're working closely with them. You things don't go well on that front. You know, it's like it's very similar to how you run your business. So I would say this is another entrepreneurial journey of yours. And Rajul and the other members on the team as well, Ravi and everybody who are part of the team. I would love to get your thoughts and insights about, you know, you've been investing for the last 5 years. What are some of the things that you've really enjoyed about investing and things that, you know, you perhaps don't like as much?
Yeah, you know, so actually, I've been investing since 2007, as I said, as part of the family office. So we've been active as an investor since 2007, with a small gap in 2012 to 2016 when I was building my startup. So the joys of investing are the same, Akash. You get to talk to very driven, very creative people every day as your job. So every day, people who are building their life's work come and, you know, tell you their vision, tell you why they're building what they're building, and give you the opportunity to join them on that journey. This is a very privileged position. I view it as such. And, you know, there is no, for me, the parts of my calendar that are the most energizing are the entrepreneur calls. So that's the new entrepreneurs, the existing entrepreneurs. And even sometimes the exited entrepreneurs, because you have occasional catch-ups there as well to sort of figure out what's next in their life journey. Those are the highlights of my day, and I truly enjoy that interaction, learning about how people are thinking about the world, how people are, you know, absorbing the new technologies, et cetera, coming in and trying to fashion them into products and services that can capture value and you know, make the world a better place and everyone's slightly wealthier. So that's the part that's the part of investment that's a lot of fun and especially venture investment. To your other point, this is really a business. It is a startup investment management business. And you have to think of it that way. You have to think of you're building an asset manager. And then there are parts of that, right? You have to do compliance, you have to do reporting, you have to do regulatory management. And those are all, unfortunately, essential parts of a GP's job. And yeah, those are can I don't know anyone who where they add sort of energy to your day when you have to spend you know an hour responding to a question a regulator has sent you, which is perhaps not tailored to VC. Half of it is for hedge funds, but you still have to answer it in any case. Those are things that take energy out of my day, but you know that's the cost of doing business.
No, I mean, you've mentioned that you've been investing for a longer time, you know, from a family office perspective, angel perspective, now as a VC, the multiple roles that the specific set of investors also play during the life cycle of a startup. And in your opinion, I would love to understand how have you evolved as an investor in all of these roles, and how has that made you better today?
Yeah, you know, I think it's the pressure that VC puts on you that changes you as an investor mostly. So VC puts two key pressures. There is a time horizon pressure, which does not exist as an angel or a family office. So as an angel or family office, you're more worried about write-offs, and you know, wins are wins. As a VC, you become much more attuned to the fact that the wins are really what matters. Because you're going to be judged by your portfolio performance, not by individual investor performance. And then you get much more attuned to the power law of venture, right? It takes a while for that to really hit home. And then I guess it makes you sort of a little bit more decisive in saying no to interesting but not very large opportunities. It makes you a lot more focused on sort of truly trying to answer, can a large company be built in the space? And I think that has been my evolution, that initially, especially in family office, one was willing to take more sort of unclear bets around the time horizon on which this company may or may not succeed. As a venture investor, you become much more focused on how long will it take, what are we really underwriting here? for it to be successful in the time horizon of the fund. So the fund life cycle puts that discipline of, will this work in the time we have for it to work? And then the fund math puts the discipline of, is this going to be big enough on its own? And I think those are both positive and negative. You know, it's having the unlimited time horizon in family offices, I think, allows you to do some interesting investments, which funds much harder to do, or you have to specialize deep tech fund or life science fund where you almost got 15 years or something of fund life cycle. But you know, on the whole, I think the discipline that the fund structure imposes is probably good for entrepreneurs, for the GPs and everyone else.
Yeah, and venture really does test your temptations from time to time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially in new sectors, category creation sectors, exciting times like 2020 and 2021, where things seem like, oh, this could perhaps be big, but then the market automatically corrects itself, and then like, oh, maybe I should have just waited a little bit. So it kind of like keeps you in check constantly. And I think that's one of the things that is hard to come by if you're a passing investor, or like you said, you're passive passing, and you're not like an active, involved investor in some sense. But if you are playing that long game, you kind of go through these cycles where you kind of like understand, and we needed this, right? We're coming back to the question that we started with, what's kind of like changed and where we are. In my opinion, we needed this kind of like a down cycle from an Indian VC standpoint, because we've not technically had those. While the global markets have seen 2000 bust, the 07, 08 financial crisis, India's kind of like seen a little bit of a lull period, but that was only because the three big, growth stage investors weren't investing between 2015 and maybe 18. That's pretty much what we call the lull period, but we haven't really gone through like a downturn. And this is the first downturn that most investors went through, that kind of like taught them a lot. And like you correctly said, it weeded out the ones that weren't meant to play this game, and kind of like taught the ones who are in this for the long haul a lot of valuable lessons. And that's what, in my opinion,
Yeah.
made an investor a good investor, is going through these times and knowing what they know now and learning from all the mistakes that they made.
Yeah, there are three words that have gone completely out of fashion: paths to profitability. Those have come back with the bang. And again, it was a rational reaction to the era of free money. A lot of the excesses were driven by, I think, later stage investors. Buying into early stage companies at inflated valuations, allowing for a lot of transactions which are not good for venture, like flipping SPVs, etc. Right, so people who just become attuned to, I invested seed, I get a 3x, and I'm able to exit 3x in a year kind of thing.
Yeah.
Those are not good incentives for venture, and I'm actually quite happy that they've gone. So now you can't flip an SPV or even a fund position for a 3x return from C to Series A, because that is not the right set of incentives and time horizons, etc., for seed investors or pre-seed investors.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. It's changed a lot of the narrative, and it's made investors today more wiser in terms of fund management and fund economics. And that hopefully makes us a stronger venture ecosystem in time. And
Certainly. Yeah.
hopefully we place better bets as well, on founders and opportunities. In some cases, make braver decisions as well, in helping bring some larger than life ideas to fruition. Now, moving on to the last segment, one thing that I typically ask most of the guests who come on the show is to share some interesting insights that they've had working with their portfolio companies. And if you were to summarize just your experience working with all the ones that you've had, what have some of the best companies in your portfolio done really well? And what are some things you hope that they can do better in the future?
It's a really good question. And I think, if I look at the sort of the meta insights, right, it the sort of the biggest insight really is that it truly boils down to the founding team, in all circumstances, and their mindsets really. So the best founders have a mindset that is more of a learning and a mindset that says that I am being able to sort of create these outcomes. Some of the weaker founders are like, this happened to our company, this happened to us. And that framing actually is the key difference. The moment I start hearing framing around, hey, this happened to us, that's why we're slightly behind, or even a win being framed as something that we were not lucky and this happened to us. So I think that has been a key insight that, you know, if you're getting founder, and we've started trying to figure it out on day one, of course, how do founders frame events? And that actually creates a difference over time as and how they react to adverse events, and then you know, how they sort of position their company to that. So that's, I think that's the sort of the highest level feedback, and it becomes more and more clear as you spend more and more time with founders. I think you know, some of the interesting things have been how founders have been able to, Indian founders have been able to hustle and build real sales organizations sitting in India, but still selling to all over the world. So, you know, countries like Japan, where we have a bunch of our founders now with significant business, without speaking the language, but still being able to, you know, find a way to do it. Western Europe, US, of course, the language is not such an issue. So the inventiveness and the, you know, just ability to get things done for the best founders continues to sort of amaze me still.
No, thanks for sharing both those insights. And you know, while you were talking about some of the things that you've learned and things that they've done really well, you know, a thought that kind of like crossed my mind is, as you're watching these founders, some of them first-time founders, go out and experiment and build something from scratch, you're kind of like also somewhere building a playbook for how things can be done and how things should, or what should be done and what can be done. And as an investor, you're getting all of the gun, you're gathering all of these insights on a regular basis. Now, that in and of itself can do what two things. One, make you a better investor by watching, and two, can make these founders better operators because you're able to give them a third party perspective, sitting on the sidelines, you know, playing that coach kind of role that you've been talking about since the start of the episode, is giving you that point of view that perhaps they are unable to see because they're too close to it. Now, when you provide this feedback to your founders, what's the it obviously, I mean, the answer here is, you know, they take it really well, but you also mentioned humility, and you also talked about a little bit somewhere, you know, if founders being arrogant. Now, arrogance can, when people talk about arrogance, they always talk about arrogance from a negative standpoint. And I don't technically look at it from that point of view. It can also just mean, you know, I'm pretty confident in myself, and therefore I'm arrogant. I've earned my right to be here. So when you look at founders, do you bet on a humble, you know, down to earth, like, hey, it's all luck, it's not me, hey, we got lucky, we hired this person, or you're more of a, I earned my right, I'm here, like, you know, we worked our asses off, it's not by any luck, we're here, we made our own luck, and therefore we're winning. Which side of the table do you fall, and what kind of founders do you typically like to align yourself with?
You know, the ideal founder, of course, is humble yet assertive. That never happens, right? You're either assertive or you're humble. But you know, being a founder is effectively inherently a very sort of selfish task, right? You're saying that, hey, this needs to change, and I'm the person going to change it. So
Yeah.
it requires a fair degree of confidence in your ability to just to be a founder most of the time. I mean, sometimes people become founders by accident, but those who thought about it are by, you know, sort of at least have that core of being confident and assertive. I think there's a fine line between assertive and arrogant. And I hear you about, you know, these are like, we can keep sort of boiling the English language to find the right words, but we think founders of more being assertive but being coachable. Those are the core things. So The ideal founder for us is somebody who will listen to a point of view, but have a strong point of view themselves, and ultimately back their own decision. And if we are comfortable that you've heard us out and still decided to do what you've done, that's fine. I think the challenge lies if you are just not willing to listen, and that is not, it's not even arrogance. It's not assertiveness. It's just, pig-headedness, and that is something that needs to be avoided.
Oh, very interesting take on that front. I agree with you. I think coachability is perhaps one of the hardest traits to also gauge as an investor in, I don't know, like four, five, six conversations that you have before you actually are able to write a check. It's very difficult to know if someone's coachable, someone's adaptable. Everybody puts on a pretty decent facade when they want to raise capital. So
Oh,
I think
absolutely. Coachability is the only thing you find out 3 quarters in, when you find out whether whether the debates are actually being constructive or just you're talking and the founder is talking, and then the founder is doing what they want to do.
Very interesting take as well. Well, the last question, again, something that is not a lot of a head scratcher, but very interesting for me to hear how people think about their own career trajectory. So if you were looking back at the start of your career, what kind of advice would you give your younger self?
Yeah, good question. So, I'd give myself, the younger self, the advice to truly think harder about what you're really good at and what you enjoy doing faster, rather than sort of solving for what seems like the right thing to do and what, is the socially acceptable right answer here in this current circumstance. So focus a little bit more on internal locus rather than external locus. But other than that, honestly, touch wood, it's been great. I have no regrets about my career. So if I was 21 again, and you told me to have to relive this whole thing, I'd probably take it.
Well, that's a great note to end the episode on. Thank you so much for your time, Shatank. It's been a great conversation where I've learned a lot from your experience and your particular takes on certain topics that both can be controversial but very hot, and also at the same time just defines who you are and the fund as a whole. So thank you again for all your insights and your time here on the show.
Thank you, Akash. Really good questions. I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks a lot for your time.